Hey, it's Greg. Welcome to the Toronto Today podcast for the 24th of April on a Wednesday. Thanks for downloading us. Don't forget to rate us, share us, and subscribe to what we do every day. We've got Think Tank coming up with three guests, former Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders, City Councillor Brad Bradford, and from Smythe Media Group, broadcaster and 640 contributor Stephanie Smythe. A lot of talk about speed limits increasing on various 400-level highways throughout the province. There are some parameters and there are some guidelines, but there's also criticism of it. We'll talk about it with our three panelists there. And as well, new comments from the chief of police again about the Umar Zamir verdict, his acquittal on first-degree murder charges on Sunday, and the comments from the current police chief, Myron Demke. We'll get to all that, plus a gentleman who listens to the show has his Corvette taken right out of his driveway on Monday night going into Tuesday morning, what the steps are to get that car back, if it's at all possible, and we'll talk to the Prime Minister's former wife. Sophie Gregoire Trudeau has a book out, and we have a conversation with her about her path forward now after that marriage has dissolved. It's all coming up next on the Toronto Today podcast.
640 Toronto presents Think Tank. The breaking stories you care about. Facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
I think it's all of that. 9 of 10 doctors agree. Let's check in with Toronto City Councillor Brad Bradford. He's on Think Tank this morning. Good morning.
How you doing, Greg?
Doing all right. We've got Mark Saunders, former Toronto Police Chief. How's Mark today?
Good morning. Very good. Thank you, Greg.
And Stephanie Smythe is with us as well. Noted early morning person. Your husband gets up when I get up. Don't ask me how I know that, and don't tell people how we know that.
Yes.
But yeah, you have to deal with what my wife deals with, which is a lot of bumbling and stumbling around, looking for things, banging of doors, fridges opening.
Oh my God!
Don't know how you handle it.
We're all waking up at 2:30 in the morning, no matter what.
2:30. I wake up around 5:28. Just ask everybody around here. I sleep here overnight. Let's start with this, and it has to do with the roads, and it has to do with speed limits. I think it's really interesting. I've gotten to drive on 402 between London and Sarnia that now has a 110-kilometer-an-hour stretch, and beginning on July 12th, Ontario has announced they'll permanently boost the speed limit to 110 on a long stretch of the 401, especially east of Toronto. Also, that 403 interchange near Brantford, people that go to London know that one really well. Brad, let's start with you. How does this land a 110 kilometer per hour speed limit on the major 400 highways?
I think probably a lot of people will welcome the announcements. Notwithstanding the fact that anytime you're in the GTA and driving around Toronto, you're pretty much always stuck in traffic and not going that fast. But the idea that people can drive responsibly, move a little bit faster, and frankly, looking at other jurisdictions across the country and in the U.S. where there are speed limits that, I think in Quebec, there's some places where it's 120. Out in Alberta as well, you go down stateside, you get 70 miles per hour. So I always find driving things work best when everybody's moving together, and it's actually those speed, the differential between speeds when you got somebody sitting there doing 90 and somebody doing 120, that's a bigger problem. And so if we can move people together and up the speed limit a little bit, I think a lot of people on those stretches, particularly southwestern Ontario, eastern Ontario, people are going to appreciate that, and it's a welcome change.
Steph, I think some people will make the dispute that we shouldn't have limits that large, and depending on time of day and depending on the stretch of highway, two lanes, three lanes, some people are going to be worried about this. How's it land for you?
Okay, so who's pretending they don't go 110 anyway when they can, right? Like, this is just upping it to where everybody's probably cruising when they can do it, right? I get not going over, a huge speed limit, but 110, it's good. It's a good move in my mind. I see there's some areas where there might be two-lane traffic. I saw Sudbury area. Not sure about that. I mean, look, I drive a lot on two-lane highways in Northern Ontario, and yeah, it can be pretty dangerous up there. But if you're going on the 401 and you've got to do that drive, man, from Toronto to Kingston, Belleville, Kingston, and the fastest you can get through that, the better.
Yeah, Mark, I think it's sort of, we're splitting hairs when we get to, like, you know, is somebody going 118? Are they going 121? I think we all have it in mind, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, that we're probably not going to get a ticket going 122 and a 100. But at the same time, people fly by us all the time on the 400 lane highways, and we think that's incredibly dangerous. I hope no one gets killed by that guy or gal, and I hope somebody stops him as well. We've got more stunt driving concerns, I feel like, than we had a decade ago, when this has been debated for a long, long time. But the stunt driving charges and the stunt driving arrests and tickets, they're still pretty important, aren't they?
No, absolutely, they are. And when you do the stats, it's well known, especially when OPP provide, that speed is the number one cause for collisions and death across our province. And so, but the factors involved in any case, no matter what the speed limit is it deals with weather conditions and the environment in which you're driving, and also your skills and abilities. And so raising the speed limit, especially after it's been well-researched, like you had said, I think it is a good thing. They certainly research to look for patterns that involve safety concerns and a host of other things. So, you know what, give it a try. Let's see where it goes. But It obviously means that there will be more research done in more areas as we go along.
And I'll follow up on this, Mark, to note for our listeners, right now a driver can be hit with a stunt driving charge for going 50K over. So that'd be 150 on 100 or 140 on the DVP, which is a 90 and not 100. But the government has noted that stays at 150. So even if we raise the limit to 110, Mark, 150 is way too fast to be going with other people around you, period, or at all.
No, absolutely. You pose such a danger to everyone else when you're doing 150 or plus. And you've seen these reports and the carnage that these types of collisions occur. But, you know, you're looking in your rearview mirror, and then next thing you know, you're gone in those types of collisions. So, you know, 150 is a good number. No one should ever be doing 150 or close to 150. And so it should stay.
All right. From a former police chief to the current police chief, we will talk about this. Myron Demkew had comments yesterday post the Zamir verdict, but he had comments on Sunday that he probably needed to address. He decided first opportunity. He was able to do so yesterday. Here's some of what he said yesterday after he said he was hoping for a different outcome. That was the exact quote on Sunday when Zamir was acquitted in the death of Constable Jeffrey Northrup. Here's Myron Demkew yesterday.
On Sunday, I thought it was clear that I supported the justice system and the work of the jury. You know, as I look back, let me be emphatic about that, how emphatic I am.
Okay, so he lays that out. Let's start with you, Mark. I mean, we've all been there. We've all, had a little bit of a muddy mouth at times, and then we need to clarify. It took a couple days. I think DemQ did the right thing yesterday, and it's tricky, isn't it, to weigh in on these proceedings, but it's also a scenario where I think I get what he was saying. He's overcome with emotion. But, Mark, what did you make Sunday when he said that? It was left too open for interpretation to me. Was it for you as well?
Well, you know, in that moment, here you have a verdict that has just come out with a very highly sensitive case. First off, you know, the organization lost, you know, Jeffrey Northrup, who was a fantastic individual. I had met him a few times because he was in the ceremonial unit. And so dealing with that, I'm sure that emotions were high. But I will say, Greg, in your head as chief, listening to the case and listening to how it's portrayed in the media and all of those things, in your head, you're thinking, what do I need to do as chief to get the public trust back? And I think that was the most important thing. And he answered that. And he answered that very clearly by making sure that transparency is the number one issue, to make sure that the OPP are now looking after that investigation. And he will stay arm's length, and this organization will stay arm's length, so that we can get to the bottom of it and figure out what can be done in the future. And on top of that, making sure that looking at that Plains Coast procedure and policy to see what improvements, there definitely will be improvements that will be made, but what will they look like and how do they translate to still create effective policing?
I will come back to you on that and ask what you expect there from any alterations to plain clothes and undercover policy. Stephanie, what did you make of the comments Sunday and the subsequent reversal, I suppose, on Tuesday from the chief?
I just have so many questions. Like, I you know, following the verdict or the trial, the verdict as closely as I could, not being in the courtroom, admittedly. But, you know, some time ago when this started, what's your name again? Greg.
Something like that. Yeah.
We were talking about when the trial was starting. I had information working back then as a journalist of what was going on in that bail hearing, right, in terms of why he was granted bail. information did leak to us, but I wasn't sitting in the courtroom. This is secondhand, but we got it through our sources about what happened in that room and the reasoning behind Zamir getting bail. I was aware of that. I'm not the chief of police. I'm not the premier, and I am not the mayor. So how did I know that information? That didn't trickle to the officials who made these kinds of comments, you know, when he was granted bail. And then with the chief post-trial, hoping for a different outcome, you know, he thought he was clear Sunday he supported the justice system. Okay, obviously, emotions took hold there. But there was a whole trial that went on displaying great concerns about the conduct of Toronto police officers in this case. And I would think that the chief would be very careful about anything he would comment on post-trial outside that courthouse on Sunday. So I was shocked he made that comment. I'm glad he's walked it back. Is it enough? I don't know.
Let me stay with you on this, because the idea of a publication ban, I mean, you're the expert among the three of us and probably all four of us to look and say, sometimes this does more harm than good, because I get the public being outraged or saying, what do they do? We have enough debates about jail or bail right now, don't we, with mm-hmm. you know, people that steal a car, rob somebody's house, and they're back in their own bed in their jammies that night. So I get that most people would go, this guy's charged with first-degree murder of a police officer, and he's walking around amongst us. We would have questions about that. And the publication ban does nothing to help clarify why that might be, does it?
Right. And I think everybody needs to take a look at these pub bans, like in cases, and the chief might be able to speak. He might be the expert here. But like in my mind, I know they're always trying to preserve a trial, right? Avoid mistrial, mm-hmm. avoid appeals. That's what it's all about. But in some cases, you know, it can't all be painted the same way, right? Some cases, there deserves explanation. And when you, I've seen through the years, whenever a police officer is killed, it is a heightened state of crisis in the city, of concern and tension. And, you know, that needs to be tampered down. And then this is an ideal classic case of that. And maybe it will spawn some kind of change.
Brad, a lot of layers to it. As politicians or even would-be politicians, I think it's okay to have opinions on the system. I think it's okay to have opinions on what needs to be altered with something that government can influence and can sway. But it's a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. And I think this case in particular has been really valuable for all of us in the public forum, in these types of discussions, and for leaders in politics as well. One thing I think people expect of their representatives and leaders is to reflect and set the tone for public opinion and make their stance clear on things. I can tell you, when these types of incidents take place, especially ones that are very emotionally charged, there's often calls for commentary. You've got the media reaching out to you. You've got pile-ons on social media. There is a lot of pressure to sort of speak out, and a lot of the times you want to. You want to go on the record, and you want to say something and weigh in on it. But I think we've seen this was a valuable lesson for a lot of folks, you know, myself included, that you need to have all of the information there. You need to have the facts, and you need to separate the emotion, how we might feel about something, from what the outcome may or may not be, because you just don't know. And I know, reflecting and looking on this, in the future, I'm going to sort of try and temper those emotional inclinations, because then you find yourself in a situation like this, and it's not good for anybody. So I see, you know, with respect to the chief's comments or other elected officials, I understand how everybody gets there. But I think it's a lesson for all of us that it's a good reminder to sort of keep our mouths shut on these types of issues involving the legal system unless you know all of the facts before you're in the courtroom.
It's funny, Steph, you're right. I mean, we in the media, we go to politicians, we go to people like Mark, people like Brad, right. And we say, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And it's I guess it's our job to ask those questions. It's their job to probably mm-hmm. say, no comment. A listener sent me video last night of Bill Clinton, then the president, reacting to the O.J. Simpson verdict in October of 95. And I bet you he's not thinking, oh, how does this play with my base? He's doing what he's supposed to do. And he's saying the justice system's there for a reason. We have to respect the verdict. Period. Two sentences. Right. That's all you can say and all you should say.
Right. And Brad is bang on. Like, you don't, just because the media asks, and I would have never said this before, just because the media asks, and God knows Mark Saunders knows this, you do not have to answer with anything. You can, no answer is good enough. They'll take a clip of you for 7 seconds saying, I'm not going to comment on this. It is before that. We'll take it. Mm. They'll take it, right? You don't have to go there and suddenly become a headline you just didn't want.
Yeah. Mark, let me reflect upon what you mentioned about the possibility of an alteration or a change to undercover and plainclothes procedures. What are those procedures and how could you see them being adapted to make everybody, to make the officers safer? A lot of complexities to this case that we won't dive into, but I think that that ended up being a key part is the ability to recognize for the officers what works and what doesn't when they're undercover.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to mention there because I will step in front of the chief of the day and I will not do that. Out of respect, and it's the right thing to do. But I do want to make a couple of commentaries.
Yeah.
Number one, we're in the real world now. So, you know, the access to information is one of the most biggest things right now. Everybody has to know everything in real time. And with that come consequences. And if you do not say anything, then what happens is, and the media is a double-edged sword, they will fill that vacuum in. And that's exactly what happens whenever chiefs or people in positions do not say anything. When it comes to this case, I just wanted from my experience in being a homicide investigator, every homicide case has what's called a judicial pretrial. In that judicial pretrial, the lead investigator, which would be me, I would sit beside the Crown Attorney, and across from the Crown Attorney would be the defense counsel, and then in between us would be the judge. And we would put out all the evidence that is going to be presented in the courts. And we'd be asking questions back and forth, where the gaps are, where the strengths are, this, that, the other. So if the public thinks that this trial walked into the courtroom and everyone was shocked at what was going to happen, then the public is misled. Because everybody knew, the officer of the court, everybody knew that this is what the evidence was going to be. So I'm kind of interested in how it made it out of the GBT. And I'm sure there's a reason for that. But again, we know that eyewitness evidence alone is not the best evidence. In fact, it is deemed the worst evidence. And that's how most people that have served sentences and have been released is because of just eyewitness testimony alone. If you don't have the science to back it up, then you generally do not bring those cases into the courtroom. And in this particular case, a lot of stuff came out early because all it was had really was eyewitness accounts. And then when you fast forward to the expert evidence, when you have the traffic reconstructionists that come out, and we don't know if it takes weeks or months to do those cases and to put those things together, well, then we start to hear about the science, and the science starts to contradict certain things that were said. So to speak right away without that science piece behind, if you can imagine, if you start talking about these publication bans and all of these things, by the time the public court of opinion has, you know, tainted that case, how does a defendant have a fair trial? So these are the things where, you know, I agree with Brad in the sense that, you know what, just weigh it out. You either believe in a judicial system. If you do, then comply with what they're asking. And right now, there's still time for an appeal to take place. So the case, in essence, is still ongoing.
So as a you're a citizen now. As a citizen, would you look at this case and say something needed to be a little more airtight about it? Like there's like somebody's every time somebody says, well, there's a leak of some sort, I'm like, yeah, there's somebody that wants it out there. Should this have been a more airtight scenario?
Well, listen, people are involved in systems and people are going to, you know, cause those error factors. And the bottom line is most people did not know about what was kept in the bail hearing and what was not disclosed. So, I mean, it worked. But again, it's hard. The public wants more information. And if you don't give information, then it gets into that discussion of transparency, lack of transparency. And I fully support that. It compels law enforcement to try to get as much out as possible in real time without jeopardizing any kind of investigation. And it's a tightrope walk. And we will get better. They will get better as time goes on. But right now, a lot of lessons will be learned from this. And I think there's a good thing coming out of that. It's unfortunate that it was expensive if Mr. Zamar, but you know, at the end of the day, an officer was lost, and there are things that need to be done to help keep the men and women safe and to help the public have trust and accountability, that the officers are doing a good job each and every day.
Yeah, that's an important answer, and that's an important balancing act. I want to give you this clip from yesterday, and we'll wrap on this topic. We obviously had a disturbance at Queen's Park yesterday. Everybody left Parliament, provincial Parliament. There was some uproar and ruckus in the crowd, all over another attempt from the Ontario NDP to overturn the CAFEA ban. Here's some of what you heard. You'll hear Paul Calandra, the housing minister, start to talk, and he's just unable to, so they suspended provincial Parliament.
Decision that was made by the Speaker. At the same time, Mr. Speaker, I'll continue on. We have amongst us the most diverse caucus in the history of this province.
This House stands in recess for 15 minutes.
Okay, important to point out, and I want to start with Brad Bradford here, because you've had city council and you've had important city businesses well disturbed by protesters. It happened yesterday. I want to know your reaction to it and sort of give us that sort of looking glass push forward as to whether we're not in the United Nations, we're not in Israeli Parliament. There's very little provincial parliament can do, let alone a city council, to sway what's happening in the Middle East. How frustrating is it to hear about things like that and hear that sound?
Well, it's extremely frustrating, and I think all of us need to be honest as Canadians and recognize that Canadian politicians, regardless of the level of government, are not going to solve thousands of years of strife and conflict in the Middle East. What we ought to be focused on is maintaining civility and, you know, in my case, in the city of Toronto, and making sure that people are not being persecuted or targeted because of their religion. And there is just far too much of that happening in Toronto right now. When it comes to disrupting the legislature or city hall, I think it's very unhelpful. The government's business of the day needs to get done. There are places for protest. But when you are weighing into the council chamber or the legislature, we can't move things forward. I don't think that is a helpful way to communicate your message. I don't think that you're ingratiating yourself or communicating in a way that people are actually going to understand. And today, I don't know what that message was. I don't know what they were trying to say. I just know that activists, you know, stormed the chamber again and shut down the government. And I don't think that's helpful.
Steph, I find the conversation's turning to where we elect city officials to handle city issues. We elect provincial officials to handle issues within the province itself. There's always going to be debate about this. Intentions are high. We've talked about this time after time. How do you view this one?
Well, it's a global village, right? So anything on the planet can hit locally. So that's just the fact of the matter. And the situation like we've been seeing in the Middle East since October 7th, it's continuing today. It's still very high tensions. And, you know, when you're talking about what's happening in the legislature right now with the CAFEA ban, this is all, you know, 10 months ago, this would not have been a discussion. But in the context of what we're dealing with right now, this is an issue. This is a problem. And it is absolutely something that's going to continue. Sarah Jama put it back on right after the vote, right? You know, in the House. And this is going to continue. More demonstrations are expected likely. What happens next? It's not going to go away no matter what. You know, as much as we can't resolve these issues, they are here at home and they are raw. And this is consistently poking the bear, right? And so, you know, as long as there's not going to be any rust with this because everybody's digging in. You're seeing what's happening in the States now, right? It's getting worse and worse. So, I mean, what happens next? Who knows in terms of local, but just because it's global doesn't mean it doesn't impact local, and it doesn't stop procedures. Obviously, it does.
Yeah, it's difficult to ignore. I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for all three of you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So that was Think Tank for this Wednesday. It airs every weekday at 7:35 and goes right into the 8 o'clock news with Dave Bradley.
We had Patrick Brown on, the mayor of Brampton, a few weeks ago, and he had gone to the Port of Montreal. And he had gone along with Chief Nish in Peel Region, who we had on last week. And those two stand at the top. I'm not throwing grenades at Mayor Chow in Toronto or Myron Demkew, the police chief here. But I think they're more vocal in doing more about car theft. Going to Montreal matters. Showing up, going, you know, showing your face where almost all these cars that are getting stolen are being loaded onto crates, signed off for, and unbeknownst or ignored by Border Patrol that handle this, they're going to other countries and they're going overseas. So every time I think it's promising, politicians are aware of it. We know we've got a bit of a crisis here. I see a story like this that transpires. And our next guest tweeted this out. He's a citizen like you and me. My Corvette was stolen last night. F this country. And I don't blame him for being angry about this. He's talked to the insurance company. He's talked to the police to lay this out there. And he's kind enough to tell us his story right now. Jim Skinner joins us on Toronto Today. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Greg. Good morning.
I'm sorry about this. First of all, there's so many people probably that have reached out based on this incident. When did it happen?
I guess sometime over the night, Monday night. So I came home from work on Monday evening, parked my car in the driveway, and I got up Tuesday morning to go to work, and it wasn't there. And there was broken glass on my driveway.
Utterly surreal feeling, but I guess seeing the glass, you know, instantly, I'm not having a nightmare. I didn't park it down the street. You know exactly what's happened, don't you?
Yeah, it took a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
So when I was walking out of my house, I couldn't see half the driveway just because of the layout of where the garage is. And I could see something on the driveway. I'm going, what the heck is that in the middle of my driveway? And I'm trying to figure it out. It looked like maybe a puddle or something because it was shiny. And then as I approached, I'm going, what is that? And then I realized, oh my God, my car's gone. And then I realized, okay, well, that was the driver's side glass.
So yeah.
We keep all of our keys in Faraday pouches, and we have for probably at least a year. I was less worried about my car because it is a sports car, and I know that there's a lot of thefts. I mean, two people on our management team at my company have had attempted thefts on their vehicles, and they were both large SUVs. Being a sports car, I was less worried about it because the number one theft, at least according to all the stories and from what I understand, is that they're going after all these high-end SUVs.
Yeah, and so the fobs, whatever happened, right? These pouches didn't do the job and didn't do the trick, did they?
Well, they do work.
Yeah.
But what I think is it's a manual transmission car. I think they smashed the window, crawled inside, took it out of gear, and rolled it down the driveway. Maybe they had a flatbed. I don't know. I checked with some neighbors to see if they had cameras. My next door neighbor doesn't have a camera. The guy across the street had one, but it's fake.
Yeah.
And we just moved in January, and we had thought about and talked about getting a surveillance system, but we didn't have one as yet. And obviously, it's going to be high on my priority list.
So 4 months, 4 months, Jim, new house, new neighborhood. And what it's really lousy. Again, my apologies, man. This is a really lousy thing to wake up to this week.
Yeah, it's disheartening. You know, there's a lot of people out there that post on social media and say, oh, car theft is a victimless crime. Insurance gives you a new vehicle, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's just not true. There's a cost to it. Insurance is very expensive. And the more these vehicles keep getting stolen, then insurance is just going to keep going up. I mean, at the end of the day, there's no free lunch. We all know that, right? Somebody's got to pay. And it's going to be the consumers. It's going to be the people paying insurance premiums that are going
to
pay.
Let's go to your first conversation calling the insurance company. How does that go for you?
So I call my insurance company. I went to leave at about 10 after 8 in the morning. So I came back inside the house. I first called the police. By the time I got done talking to them, it was about 8:45. I called my insurance company. And she says, you're my third call today. It's 8:45 in the morning.
She says,
my third stolen vehicle of the day. Third. And then when the constable called me back, so I filed a preliminary report with Peel Regional, and she said, someone will call you back later to take the full report. He called me back early afternoon. He said, and I told him what my insurance company said, that, you know, it was her third stolen vehicle of the day already at 8:45. He goes, when I came into work this morning, there was 50 stolen vehicles on the board for me to log. 50. And he goes, that's just 11 division. I said, that's not all GTA. That's just 11 division here in Peel. 50.
And so let's even document. That's like, we can do some quick math, Jim. That takes, if it took 10 minutes to do each log, let's say it did. I don't know if it does. That's 500 minutes. That's 8 straight hours plus 20 minutes of work. So he isn't getting all of that done in one day, probably even 2 work days. There's no way.
And they don't do any investigation. I mean, he's just basically filling out a report and giving me a report number to give to my insurance company. You know, he said there's maybe a 20% chance. They don't investigate. He said, we might get lucky. He said, sometimes they dump these cars off and they wait a few days and they go back and pick them up. He goes, and sometimes you know, police officers will see something that looks suspicious and they'll run the plate. And if they realize it's stolen, then the vehicle gets recovered. But he said maybe 20%, maybe.
And so I mentioned having Mayor Brown on, and he goes to the Port of Montreal. He talks to border officials there. He says all it takes is the federal government, and it's not cheap. That's fine. But we spend a lot of money, billions of dollars all over the planet. It takes a little bit of investment to get these scanners and to actually have people do the job. This isn't the epidemic, as you probably know, Jim, and in the States that it is here. Why? Borders are tighter and they're more secure. And these people wouldn't take your car to just tool it around and go for a joyride. They're doing it as an investment to sell for tens of thousands of dollars to go overseas. And if we cut off that supply chain, that doesn't happen to you the other night. It's madness.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, these politicians, they don't care. Clearly, they don't care. It's not important to them. I don't understand it. I mean, you know, we've gone from broken windows to nobody's safe. I mean, I live in Meadowvale. I live in Meadowvale in Mississauga. It's a nice neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I wake up and my car's gone. That's insane to me. As a middle-aged man that grew up in Mississauga, like, we didn't have crime like that when I was growing up. It didn't happen.
No, nobody thought the world would ever arrive to where, you know, that the, and I guess it was a dumb thing to say, the cops like, hey, just leave the keys by the front door. That's all they want is your car. And as opposed to, hey, we know this is a problem and we're going to catch the bad guys for you. That would have been the sentiment in the 70s, 80s and 90s, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, I'm in the position now. What do I do now? I mean, I might get enough from my insurance company to replace it. I mean, it was a 7-year-old car. They don't make them anymore.
They
skyrocketed in value. So I don't even know if I will get the money to replace it. It's crazy. But then I think, what am I going to do then? Are they just going to come back and wait for me to replace it? Because I've heard that happens. Is that they steal somebody's vehicle, they wait for the insurance company to replace it, and they just come back and get the replacement.
I just feel like anybody that says it's a victimless crime, Jim, doesn't either own a car or just doesn't have any sentiment about a car. I can remember sitting in the first car that my dad helped me buy, a 1983 Mazda RX-7. And every time I see one go by, I just get the goosebumps. So you had a pretty special car that not only was rare, but appreciated in value. Like, you don't have to, you shouldn't apologize that matters to you so much and that it pisses you off.
Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with my wife last night. Like, I wanted a car like that for years, and it was a pipe dream for me, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And I remember just as a joke, putting it on her whiteboard grocery list on the fridge, just as a little joke, I put, you know, Corvette Z06. And eventually we got to a point where empty nesters, the kids are growing up, they've moved out, you know, we've worked hard in our careers. Mm-hmm. And I eventually bought one. And, you know, we went out together and she fell in love with this car. She is not a car person per se. But she came with me to the dealership. I was looking at a different one. That car was in the showroom and she was like, oh my God, I love this car. And we bought it. We bought it together. And, you know, we've gone on several road trips in it. And, you know, she has bought me some modifications. My son and I have worked on the car together. I'm getting a little emotional talking about it, but it is. It's not just a bauble, you know?
No. And you said it. The politicians all need to care a lot more. I'm going to send this chat to Mayor Brown. I'm going to send it to Chief Nish. And if we can move this needle at all to get this car back, that matters to us. I appreciate you coming on this morning. I'm out of time, but let's keep in touch on this front, Jim.
Thank you for having me, Greg. Thank you so much. You have a great day.
You bet. There's Jim Skinner. Had his Corvette stolen right out of his driveway on Monday. Last summer, August it was, 18 years of marriage came to an end for our next guest. And, well, not just any husband, the Prime Minister of this country. Our guest has a new book out. She's talking about it, and she's talking about it in the book, and she's talking about the book and all that's happened since August with us right now. Sophie Gregoire Trudeau joins us. The book is called Closer Together. Thanks for the time. It was a book always in the works at some point, and why is this the right time to tell your story?
Well, you know, I've been on the mental health and well-being path for 20 years now, and when I shared my story in my early 20s, when I was a newcomer on the radio and television industry in Quebec, A girlfriend of mine who I went to school with approached me because she was starting this organization and foundation called BACA, B-A-C-A, which stands for Bulimie, Anorexie, and Comportement Alimentaire. And she knew that I was suffering, and I had seen so many people, so many young girls and boys actually suffer around me. So when she said, do you want to get involved? You want to do something? I said, absolutely, yes. And I remember the night before sharing my story, because I knew that I couldn't become an ambassador for them if I hid from the fact that I suffered from an eating disorder. I asked myself, you know, I'm not going to get any contracts after this. They're just going to see me as the girl who's the bulimic or whatever. Because in those days, we weren't really talking about eating disorders the same way we do now. And life proved me differently. It proved me that when you live from an authentic place and you expose yourself vulnerably, it's not easy. But in the end, you know, I think goodness comes back and it gravitates and people feel safe in your presence. And for me, that's the greatest gift I could ever imagine in life, is that other humans feel safe in my presence. So the book came to me, I think, through all these years, and took its content from my own experience, because you can't really teach from anything other than experience. So because I did a lot of work on my healing path and my self-discovery path, and I wanted, for me, human connection is everything, and I'm an only child, so the other is a source of nourishment and solace for me. The book came together with a lot of, you know, labor of love and yeah, team effort. The knowledge that I was getting was something that was of universal interest. That's what I noticed. And I said, well, I'm so happy to be able to share it in a book with as many people as possible now.
I know you write about it. We've got a lot more understanding of when someone's in trouble than when we did when I was a kid. I was born in the early 70s. So you're in the 80s in high school, and you don't know where to turn when you're having problems. Nobody did. But I'd make the case, Sophie, there's a lot more minefields out there. There's social media is a big one. Bullying's a bigger one. We would not be able to stand for that as much. It feels like we're teaching kids not to be bullies, and they're being bullies more than ever. It's a real balancing act. I'm raising teenagers just like the world you've gotten into, and there's more services, but it feels like there's more minefields.
I absolutely agree with you. You know, in the book, I talk with a very well-known psychologist called Rose Marie Charest. And she said in her, like, I think it's 30 or 40 years of practice, that she's now concluded that the human beings that suffer the most and that are unhappy are the ones who cannot trust others. And when we live in a world where constant competition, comparison, inauthenticity, self-betrayal, you know, we are rewarded for self-betrayal, for hating ourselves, for wanting to change ourselves physically, mentally, never fitting in, never being good enough, never being, you know, performant enough. And when our concept of success is related with recognition instead of contribution, we truly suffer, because it's insulting to the beauty of our true nature, which is creative, which seeks connection, which wants to come into relationship with others and feel cared for and validated. So I think that not only do we have to be even more discerning of our sources of consumption, because we become what we bring our attention to, but as parents of young children or of teenagers, we also have to really be, I would say, to really look at the truth of their environment as it is. You know, sometimes I think, oh my goodness, it so wasn't like that in my days, yeah, but it's a different version of it. Right. And the difference is the flow of information and the distortion of truth, which actually plays mind games with us. And the more we are in control of our own mind wiring and understanding of our own emotions and how we can regulate and co-regulate, the better we'll be equipped to face all these crises that we're facing as societies and as a world.
The book's called Closer Together, Knowing Ourselves, Loving Each Other. Sophie Grégoire-Trudeau is joining us on the Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. I love a quote you gave to Vogue magazine. I don't say that to everybody I come across. But one of your quotes was, I've thought about this sentence. I'm like a wild horse in a stall. And I think of somebody that is a president's wife or a prime minister's wife. You've got this amazing kinship with Michelle Obama. You're still friends to this day. And I think to myself, that's hard for a wild horse to sort of be that role. How long did it take even for you to sort of morph into it, grow into it? And I guess you were unconventional at it though too, which was great. People like that.
You make me laugh because I never perceived myself as the wife of somebody or, you know, the role of first lady. It was attributed to me de facto. Mm-hmm. I've met enough people in my life who have incredible titles and some who have none. And it is very clear to me that the only thing that differentiates us as human beings is that we are one trauma away from each other, one or a series of little traumas chronically. Our brains are shared. We have the same brain for 200,000 years. And that is the hard wiring, like a computer. The programming of our brain differs on how we were taken care of as children, our childhood bond of attachment, and how we took that into our teenage years. And were we rebellious or not? Did we get to express our real true selves? And the more we repress our emotions, the more we keep the sadness inside or the anger inside, the worse the difficult emotions get. And then, you know, a great knot of emotions that is very difficult to understand will be kind of dictating our actions, because we actually we're not holding the reins of our own emotional system. And that needs to change. We teach children how to count, how to write, how to pinpoint a country on a map. We need to be able to educate ourselves on emotional literacy and how to understand our own nervous systems, our own human bodies, how our brains are wired, and how we can affect easily our level of emotions, of states, as we grow in our everyday lives through our habits and through our level of attention, presence, and consciousness and awareness.
I know we got limited time, but I'd love to know from you if you're getting to do things now that you weren't before. Are you even able to be a person you weren't able to be because of those constraints we were just talking about?
So if you knew me, you'd ask the question differently, because, you know, I have a strong personality. I'm a very sensitive woman. I love humans. As an only child, for me, humans became a source of solace. I'm still like that. I'm still playful. I'm still looking for real, deep, you know, meaningful connections and relationships. And I've learned a lot along the way. And, you know, we live in a world where the perception of the world against us or you know, how it wants to mold us or change us. I don't want humans living in that place. I don't want my fellow sisters and brothers to suffer in silence because, you know, they're longing for a connection. You know, trauma is not just what happened that was bad to you. It's also what should have taken place and didn't happen. And I'm citing Gabor Mate here, the great specialist on trauma. But this is important. This is not, mental health is not a cause. Mental health is a reality. It's a universal common denominator. And if we better understand ourselves, we'll be able to come closer together, no pun intended, because it's the title of my book. But it is only by coming closer together that we'll be able to not only face the troubles that we are faced with as a human species, but also thrive, not just survive.
The book is called Closer Together. Congratulations on it. I think people will be excited to read it and hear from you and certainly see more of you. I really appreciate the time and you coming on the air here in Toronto with me.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you for this compliment. I'll put it in my heart. Thank you.
Sophie Gregoire-Trudeau, book's called Closer Together. You can find it where people buy books.
Thanks for listening to the Toronto Today podcast. We drop the highlights of The Daily Show every weekday morning at 11 a.m. Don't forget, you can hear the entire show on the radio, at home, on your smart speaker. Ask Alexa or say, hey, Google, play 640 Toronto or Toronto Today. You can hear us on between 5:30 and 9 weekdays on 640 Toronto. Have a great day.